Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 90-year-old Doug Justice of Visalia, California. He served with the 81st Infantry Division in the Pacific during World War II, and here are the first words he heard after arriving overseas in New Caledonia.
You guys in the first line here, follow me. Leave your bags right here. Okay, we went. Got over there, and they had tarps with ropes stretched between the coconut trees, you know, the big trees. Our duty that he gave us was going through the pockets and all those kids that were dead and taking their stuff and putting it in a little rubberized bag. Anyway, that was my first thing of seeing all those young guys that's no arms, face, all no feet, you know, just terrible stuff.
And you're just a teenager?
Yeah, 18 years old.
Did that make you sick to your stomach?
Well, it was very bad. Yeah, it was really bad. A lot of guys throwed up, and I cried like heck, but I didn't get sick at my stomach.
Welcome to the war.
Yeah, and so that was my introduce to the war. The next time I got kind of by myself, not by myself, you never were by yourself hardly, but where I could still think about it as how useless. I just felt, why can't they settle things with, you know, that was my feelings. Actually, the thing that bothered me the most is the guys that, not that time, another time, I don't know what island it was on, burying those guys. You know, you'd go out and you'd dig the trenches. Then you'd go out there when you were trying to bury him, and there'd be a guy laying there on both sides of him, and he'd be wrapped up in a blanket, and they'd play taps. Off that, and you pull the blanket and they roll in the holes. That bothered me worse than anything. That was hard. And I got to know the guys, but after I got to being in charge of other guys, you got to help them, charge of them, and you want to do the right thing. That was bad.
You feel responsible for whether or not they live?
Yeah. You feel responsible for them. And you know them. You've talked to them. Oh, they come from this place. And my dad and mom and my brother and sisters or my girlfriend or whatever. You know, and you get to know them. So it didn't take me long to find out I didn't want to know them. I wanted to know their name.
And that was it.
Jackson. Get up, Jackson, Pete, Joe, whatever. Because, you know, you go out and you do your thing. You come back and some of them are gone already.
Well, and that's just it. Mathematically, you know you're going to lose a lot of these guys.
Yeah. Well, when we were training to go to Japan, they told us it would be, you know, 70% kill.
If you made the eventual invasion of mainland Japan.
Yeah.
Right. But even in the battles you were in, there were losses. You were at Peleliu, yeah. Philippines, Okinawa.
Well, you know, and what bothers me most, Paul, is I don't know how I got to these places.
You remember some of the incidents, but you don't remember showing up on those islands?
Nope. I remember on the hatch. The pastor, the minister there was, you know, tell us God be with you and give you strength and all this kind of stuff, you know, saying some of you are not going to come back and told us that stuff. I remember that part. And I remember going over to the side.
I bet you got shot at a little bit.
Well, I never got hit. I got hurt a few times. The one time I got hurt, what my squad was going to do, I've been told. Of course, in them days, you know, aerial photos didn't show any elevation. So you looked at it and said, oh, that's easy. That's just flat beach right up to the jungle.
Right.
Get there and there'd be a 30-foot cliff up there.
Oof.
You thought, oh, you got it all planned out.
Until you get there.
Totally chaos.
So you said, so your squad, you knew what your objective was.
Yeah, I was supposed to go to the left. They would know you're coming, of course, and them islands, a lot of them had been Jap-mandated for hundreds of years. And so they had these pillboxes or however big the beach was or whatever it was, and so they'd crossfire. And they already knew exactly at the exact range that you were at.
They knew where you guys were going and had it zeroed in and could pick you off.
Yeah, their mortars, they had practiced, and they knew how they put much emigrants you put in that tube, and they all knew that stuff. So the thing went down. I ran off to the side. I have to take all the ammunition you can carry, and then I had a 30 caliber machine gun on my shoulder. The thing went down. Then I don't know what happened. I have no idea. Next I know, a guy hollers, hey, here's a guy over here. I'm laying there. I remember trying to get the sand out of my eyes and my mouth. and stuff. And I'm laying there, and this guy runs up to me, hollers back to the coxswain that just came in with a load of supplies, and he says, there's a guy over here. So he took me over there, and I had a tag on me. Some medic had tagged me, and they gave me painkiller, morphine, or whatever he did. And then I went on the boat, and they took me. I never tell this story much because people think you're stupid or something, but these guys put me up in front of the windshield on this boat, Higgins, I believe they call them.
The LCVPs?
Yeah. They set me up on the top.
Uh-huh.
And then he backed out, made a big turn, because I was, you know, all...
You're out of it.
Yeah, I was out of it. And I slid off into the water. They were going.
They kept going?
Well, they did. And the coxswain was going. And the other guy, because there's always two guys on those, hollered, and I was just bobbing in there. And he hollered at him, turn around, I can get him. I can get him. Turn around. He turned around and come by, and they have a pole on those things. He hooked me up and pulled me in. And there was a Navy hospital ship out there thing and put me up the side. And I wasn't shot or nothing. I had this arm. Instead of being this way, it was going that way.
You dislocated your elbow or something?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I didn't know what happened to the... There was something else that was wrong. But anyway, they put him up there, and I stayed there for, I don't know how long, 10 days. As soon as they got a hospital on the land, you know, take over some building or something. And so they got that, then they sent me over there.
And you don't know what happened. You just remember the door flipping down and you going out, and then the next thing you do, you're waking up because they found you.
Yeah,
because
when I went down, I remember going up in the air, and I had this stuff on, and I put this arm down to brace the fall, and I guess that's when it popped out or whatever.
So maybe there was further to go from that door than you thought there was.
Huh? Probably. Could be. You get out on there, and you got to be careful. Because you're landing that thing, and if they don't go in far enough, some of them get kind of scared, you know. And they don't go in far enough to let that come down where they hit the ground. The wave comes, and that thing goes like that. It'll throw you whichever way. So I don't know if that's what happened. When I woke up, all my ammunition was gone, and gun thing was gone, and there was nothing there.
And nobody ever told you later, nobody that was with you or anything?
No.
So how long were you out of commission?
Oh, I was out for quite a little while. My arm had swollen up huge. And the doctor come in, it was a colonel, and he looked at my arm, and he says, well, we'll put a tin on it, heat. The arm is just huge. And it starts smelling. And you could actually take, Paul, you could take my fingers and go like that and just dig out flesh, and it was just mush.
Ugh.
You know, and it was very, smelled like terrible. So I'm laying there in this hospital, and this little Japanese lady came down there, and she says to me, wanted to know if that guy down there that was cleaning and stuff could look at my arm, Japanese man. And I said, sure. So he came down, took off the thing, and he looked at my arm. He started right here.
Started by your wrist?
To find the first cord or whatever you want there in my wrist. Nerve or whatever. He'd start with his thumb and he'd work it up till he lost it and he'd go back. He did that probably for 10 minutes, whatever. Put the thing back on, leave.
Bowed to you and left. Yeah.
Goes on like that for, he was working on me probably 4 days. And the doctor comes in. He looked at it, my arm was going down. Still smelled terrible, but it was going down. He says, well, he says, I see that's working. And I said, no, sir. I said, see that guy you got cleaning the toilets? He was a doctor. I says, he's the one that fixed my arm. He gave me the dirtiest look you ever seen in your whole life. Walked out, and I never seen him again.
Mm.
But that little Japanese guy is the one that fixed this arm. That big colonel guy says, your arm will always be, you'll never be able to straighten your arm, he told me. I don't know if I should be telling you all this dumb stuff, but when I was a young boy living on that 10 acres, and my nephew and I, Tommy, played in the barn and playing at that, and he fell out. Tore up this arm.
Yeah.
My mother straightened it out, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
She took her big old flat iron, you sit on the stove.
Yeah.
And made him carry it.
Uh-huh.
Because his arm was like that when he got out of the sling.
So his was bent at the elbow, and she straightened it out by having him carry the weight around.
I got out of that hospital, and I was trying to find my unit.
Yeah.
I was just walking.
Right.
And I come along with a big hunk of rock laying in the road.
Uh-huh.
I picked it up. I carried it till somebody told me, well, you're up. It's on the end of the aisle or whatever it was. And I go there. They sent me to the medic, and he looked at me. What are you carrying the rock for? I told him. So he took some gauze and put it in there so it'd stay there.
Yeah.
And I carried that sucker around until that arm was like that.
You carried the rock until your arm was straight.
Yep.
I love it. I love it. That's great.
So that those are little things that, you know, have. I did probably 100,000 guys had more things to do than me, but that was my own little experiences.
And who knows, maybe that time out of combat saved your life again. I mean, you don't get sent over with those paratroopers, and now here's a situation where you're hurt coming out of the boat.
Well, I had three times, I'll tell you, Paul, I had three times that absolutely truthful in my own heart, I knew God had a plan for me. Because missing that trip with all those guys I'd trained with, all good friends now, getting home, gone. I went to these other guys. The theory was that the Marines came and landed on Peleliu. We are here as their backup.
Right.
So we ended up cleaning up a little bit, and then they wanted Angar because it's flat.
Right.
It's all coil. So they wanted it for an airfield. So then we went there and got that. That's where our captain, Captain Talmadge from New York, there wasn't a lot of trees on that island. It's all coil. Well, up high on the high land ground was these rocks and things up there. Yeah. Unbeknown to us, there was caves on that whole thing. And so to let the engineers come and start the airport, we had to get rid of those guys up there because they had, we found out later, but we thought they had a whole bunch of those 77-millimeter cannons, the small ones.
Yeah.
And they could shoot from up there. So they'd shoot, want to go off over here, and a little while later they'd go off over here. After we found out and got in there, they had a little track, and they pushed this thing from place to place.
Yeah, it was on train tracks. Yeah, yep.
And they'd push it from place to place.
Yeah.
And so, but tell them we had to go up there and get them out. So that's where we were going up there, and Captain Tolley come by me, and he said something to me. I think I got in behind a big coil rock or something. I could hear the bullets, you know. And if you ever hear pop air by you, it's a, you know. But anyway, and he said, just that you can't win the war behind the rock. And I said, yes, sir. So he took off. And so I got myself up and I was ready to go follow him. And I heard him hollering. I said, oh, man. You know, and so I stopped, got myself back off under that rock. And I moved over to the right. And there was a kind of a big, where the coil had came about like a half moon and up and around. And I got there. So now I'm sitting there thinking, what the heck? You know, I ain't going out there because that was their whole thing. They'd shoot somebody. I went in, he scrawled. Another guy goes out there and they kill him.
When you say you heard him hollering, you're thinking he just got killed.
Well, yeah, I thought so. Yeah. But he was hollering, so I knew he was still. I sat for, I don't know how long, probably seconds. But so I said, how do I get out of here? So I move around in this coil and I go this way. And there's a, goes there, and there's kind of in between little place. I could squirm around through there, and I got out of there, and I'm trying to see out across that field because we were down here, and the depths were up there, trying to find out where that fire was coming from. And I get over there a little ways, and I had to move a couple of times, and then I seen two guys up on the coil up there, and they had a machine gun. One was shooting, and the other was loading the bullets, you know, holding the belt.
You could see the loader, but not the gunner.
I could see the loader.
Yeah.
And so I whacked him one, and he went down. Then the guy that was shooting the gun got up to run. I was able to get him, too. That stopped all that crossfire on that ridge. That was something. Well, anyway, Talmadge, I got to him, and I put some sulfur in his wounds, his legs. And after that thing was over, I don't know, it was a couple of days or whatever it was, I went back. And, of course, if you've ever been in that, they got tent of wounded.
Right.
All lined up. So I went back. I'm walking up and down these aisles to find him, and I find him, and he's laying in his cot. He said, well, just as I get to go home, I says, you're faking it, you know. And anyway, we talked and visited for a while. I was sitting on the edge of his bed. In come two lieutenants, fresh from school. They had on white leggings, gloves, just like they did in when they were in the academy.
Yeah.
And they come in, and they looked up, and they saluted him, and I saluted them. They were questioning him, and he was telling them the situations that he had seen so far and all this kind of stuff. After quite a little while, he says, you guys, watch this kid. He says, if you want to go home, tell you what he tells you. Yeah. Of course, they want this kid to tell me nothing more. But anyway, it turned out they were good guys, and we made it through there. Finally got up to those holes, finally got up there. The biggest thing that helped us was their bonsai charges at just before dark. They would come and then it hit the ground and filter through, you know, because
yeah.
I knew that place, that was their home.
Right.
But the flamethrowers were the absolutely answer to stop that.
Mm.
We'd get a flamethrower and they'd bring them to us at dark or before dark. And we had two. When they'd start coming down, then you could just light up the whole thing.
Mm.
And that's one thing they didn't like is the fire. You could shoot them a dozen times and they still kept coming with that sake in them. So that stopped that.
Mm.
That stopped that thing. And then we got up to the cliffs and found out like all those caves and stuff. It was a kind of a neat battle, really. I mean, it wasn't big, enormous, or nothing like that. But it was just a concentrated stronghold for them.
It would have been big enough to take your life.
Oh, a lot of guys didn't make it, but I came out of that fine. I didn't get hurt or nothing. We secured the island. The guys made the airstrip, and we stayed there for I don't know how long we stayed there.
But that was another time where you felt somebody was looking out for you.
I tell you what, that was it. That was the whole unbelievable stuff to me.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't hardly imagine that what God had planned for me because I can't even think about it. But
what?
That was a good life. I wouldn't want to do it again.
Yeah.
At all, but I growed up. Like my mother says, you win way 18, come back at 40.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was it like to come back? What did that mean to you?
Well, things that you can't imagine that happened, Paul. We left at Japan on Admiral Capps. It's a big ship.
Yeah.
Two-stacker. 5,000 troops and plus the crew. We left Japan to come to San Francisco. We got in a storm where we were stayed up all night, all day, with the coxswain standing in front of us in our holes, telling us which way to go so the boat wouldn't turn over. And he'd this way, and we'd all go that way. And then we'd go this way. We ended up in Seattle. That's where that thing ended up, in Seattle. That's where I got discharged from, instead of San Francisco. And I got home. I can't tell you how I got home from Seattle, but I got home, come in a taxi to my house. And it was, I would say, probably 4 o'clock in the morning when I got there. And I got out and I stepped out on the ground and I looked around. It was different. I got back in the cab with one foot still on the ground. And here come my mother out the door onto the porch. Then I was okay. I went in.
Mm.
And it was good. My folks and my kid brothers and sisters were super to me. They really were super. They helped me a lot.
But what about that big brother, Bert? That's a story that was pretty murky until the last few years. The details that Doug has found since and the way he got to honor his late brother in Washington, D.C. All of that and more when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.